Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Coming up, the shipwreck uncovered on a Dorset beach during a storm.
The new techniques Time Team's Henry Chapman is using to unravel the mysteries of Stonehenge.
And building up to the current Archaeology Awards.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams, where later on you'll hear about the exciting news from the Cern Abbas chalk giant. Lots more research is being planned. We'll tell you all about it.
We will indeed. First, Helen, I hear you've been bobbing about in a boat with the new ships company. And maybe I should explain a little bit more, because just to fill you in, if you are new to Time Team, we've recently spent a lot of time at Sutton Hoo, which is the site of a huge Anglo-Saxon burial site. And there are these enormous mounds, some of which contain ships, and they would have been dragged up, these ships would have been dragged up this steep hill from the river below and then buried. And it's long been a source of real interest and intrigue, so much so that in the nearby town of Woodbridge, volunteers are in the process of building an exact replica of one of the ships, and they plan to actually use it and get out there on the water with it. And you, Helen, have recently been along to check on the progress.
Yes. Now, I was in Woodbridge the other day for a trustees meeting. So I'm one of the trustees of the ship project. And I heard that one of the other trustees was going to go out on the water, on the River Deben, to test something that seems quite arcane, but it is, in fact, quite crucial. It's the way that the oars pivot on the shear strake, which is the top of the ship. They're held on, or they're pivoted against something called souls. The vocabulary of this stuff is absolutely wonderful. Anyway, I thought I'd go down and take some photographs because I was in Woodbridge anyway. And I was lucky enough when I got there to be offered a place in the bow as ballast.
Oh, wow. But this isn't the actual ship, is it? This is much smaller, completely different ship.
Yes. This is a half-size replica of the Mound 1 ship, which is the one that's being built at the moment. So really, we should all the people doing the testing should be half-size humans with half-size oars. But but what we're trying to do is prepare for those final experiments that are on the full-size ship. We don't want to do too much modification to the full-size ship. We want to get our ideas in as nailed down as we can before we get to that point, so that we get the best and strongest build. We haven't had to do so many modifications. So there are about eight of us in the ship, in the half-size variant called Say Wolfing. There were six people rowing, and then there was a steerer, and then there was me as ballast. Now, I'm not sure I was really needed as ballast, because the thing that struck me when I first stepped in is that the ship is incredibly stable. And it was really easy to move around as it was moving on the water. And perhaps as a result of that, they offered me a chance to have a go at the rowing. And it was amazing. It wasn't nearly as hard as I thought it was going to be, because I don't have a rowing background. I'm a complete novice. But one of the great things is, because the rowers are a team, you can almost contribute as much or as little as you can. You have to keep the speed up, but you don't have to put as much pressure on. If you're a really good, strong, trained rower, you can put a lot of effort in and move the ship very fast. If you're not so strong, not so good, as long as you keep the rhythm up, you can put as much or as little effort into as you want to or need to. You just have to copy the person in front of you and keep going.
Well, I just want to bring you a little bit of the sounds of this. So this is the podcast world now. We're doing this because these are the sounds of Helen actually in the ship, on the water. Listen to this. Oh, the sound of the water and of the oars dipping in. It's like I'm there.
Well, I think you can feel quite glad you're not, because I bet you're sitting on a comfy cushioned seat at the moment. And it was so hard on the backside. Really, really painful. I've never thought that I have a thin skin on my bottom. I've always thought it's well padded with fat and muscle. But no, not if you're sitting on one of those benches. It was excruciating.
They think you're made of sterner stuff. That's what it is. Well, of course, there's lots of work that's been going on at the moment, not just with kind of learning how to row and understanding the mechanics. There's still work actually going on in the long shed at Woodbridge to actually build this thing at the moment. So let's hear from one of the Sutton Hoo Ships Company volunteers, the people who are actually tasked with constructing the ship using those traditional techniques.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm one of the crew that's helping to build the ship. So what you see here are five of the eight wedges. A week and a half ago, we had this giant 350-year-old oak tree from Wales. I mean, it was like the largest log that we split. And then, so we finally have wide enough wood to finish a strake eight on the boat. So I'm working on one of the planks. And we also, Lori, the main shipwright, had determined we can actually use a couple of these for the shear strake. So we're actually, it's like even better than we had planned with this wood, which is awesome.
There's Dave then. What's he talking about, Helen? I don't understand what he's going on about.
No, well, I can quite see the problem. The wedges that he's talking about are the cleft trunks. They are, as he says, a very, very special tree, very, very wide. As you come up the line of the ship from the keel, the planks that you need to build become wider and wider and wider. And we know this from the lines of the rivets in the sand. So we know the shape of what we're building from the remains at Mound 1 at Sutton Hoo. But also, if you think about it, it's partly because the twist that you need to get from the lower planks right up to the stem and stern posts, they need to rise up and also twist. But the outer planks don't, so they could be much wider. And we're trying to match those ancient trees from the 7th century with modern trees, and it's very difficult. It's taken us a very long time to source these incredibly wide planks. And what we decided to do was see if we could get the timber to make it in one piece. And if we could, we'd try it like that. And amazingly, we did manage to find timber that we could use.
It's such an exciting story and all the twists and turns of it. I love following it. And one of them is the name of the ship. And I think we need to get yes. Jack Barnard back on soon, because she's been looking through, because they asked for people to suggest names, didn't they? She's been looking through all these name suggestions. And I know that she's up for sharing some of the ones that they rejected. So I am quite interested to hear about that.
Yes, me too. We did see a couple of suggestions at that trustees meeting the other day, and there was this kind of shocked silence before somebody said, "Oh, are these really the best ones we got?" And Jack said, "No, they are the rejected ones. These are the funniest of the rejected ones." So there was a huge sigh of relief. But there's some amazingly imaginatively bad ones. We do have to get Jack on to share those with us, I think.
Yeah, well, let's absolutely do that, because I can't wait to hear some of those rejected suggestions. Just before we move on, by the way, I wanted to talk about the Sir Nabus Giant in Dorset, because I mentioned that we were going to talk about it. This is something that we've, of course, featured quite heavily on Time Team recently. We made a film about it recently, which followed the excavation of Sir Nabus Abbey, which lies at the foot of that famous chalk man with a big willy. And following a fundraising campaign, the National Trust has announced it's bought a lot of the land around the giant, which it didn't previously own. And it's got a lot of plans for the area. And I suppose this is quite interesting for us, Helen, because we want to know if they've got any plans to do any digging.
Absolutely. I mean, they've been trying to get their hands on the surroundings of the giant, the National Trust have, for years, for two reasons. One is that it's a really interesting chalk grassland habitat. It's got masses of rare butterflies and so on there. But the other one is that the giant is almost still as mysterious as it ever has been, even though now we know how old it is. So we still really need to know more about it. And one of the weird things is that although other chalk figures like the Uffington White Horse are mentioned in medieval documents that describe the landscape, the Cernabis giant isn't, even though descriptions of the landscape include the other landmark that's on the same hill, the mysterious enclosure that's known as the Trendle. They do mention the Trendle, but they don't mention the giant. And this is really consistent over the centuries. Now, maybe that's because if you've got one landmark close to another, you don't need to mention both. But it's really strange. Whatever the reason is, that was one of the big planks of evidence to suggest that the giant wasn't very old before the scientific dating was done. So we've now got the scientific dating, which confirms that it is really mysterious. Why is this huge hill figure, which you cannot not notice, never mentioned? It must have been being maintained. You can't just ignore it. It would have disappeared. People are interacting with the giant, but it's never mentioned. Now, we've probably done enough work at the giant itself to be getting on with. The answers to these questions are going to come from the landscape that it was set in. And as I understand it, we know almost nothing about the Trendle at the moment. It's just so mysterious and tantalising, the relationship between the two, because they're both very mysterious and very odd and don't appear to relate to each other. So there's this Iron Age settlement on top of the hill with earthworks, field systems, that kind of thing. We understand that. But the Trendle is lower down. It's right next to the giant, kind of above his head, and it's much smaller. It's only about 20 metres square, so it's like the size of a small play area or a small car park, something like that. But it's got this double bank around it, so it's very clearly marked out. Now, one of the suggestions is, apparently in the 19th century, people said, oh, that's where we used to do the maypole dancing. But other people said, no, it's not, you know, and there were disagreements even then. And I don't think that really helps anyway. Even if you did use it for maypole dancing in the 19th century, it's not 19th century in date.
No.
Could it just be Iron Age?
Maybe it was the horse and cart park. Instead.
For visitors.
Yes.
Maybe it is something to do with people using the giant, visiting the giant, having fun, that kind of thing. Although I hate to suggest something entirely different, Martin, when you have such a good theory that it's visitor services. It has been suggested it might be a temple.
I think that might be a bit more likely.
Take your pick.
But this is it, though, isn't it? It'd be so interesting to find out. So, you know, watch this space. We'll keep you updated with whatever they say. I know as well that they are going to be sort of on another thing that they're doing, not archaeological. They're going to be re-chalking the giant soon. I think they're looking for volunteers, people who would get to do that, which will imagine being somebody who gets to be part of that process. That must be amazing. Anyway, watch this space. We will see what they decide to do on that. Moving on now, but actually staying in Dorset, because I want to talk about a shipwreck. And it seems we love a shipwreck on this podcast. So when I saw news of another one being uncovered on the beach at Studland Bay in the wake of Storm Chandra, you remember, a few weeks ago, I needed to find out more.
Yes. Now, you might well ask why we love shipwrecks so much on this podcast when they're not an enormous part of what archaeologists do every day in their daily lives. But I think it's because it's all about transport, which I find absolutely fascinating. It's so hard to understand communications and movement in the past. And there's so much secondary circumstantial evidence for it, but we hardly ever get something that's really solidly connected, a real piece of primary evidence. And I think this interests us more than it used to, I think, Martin, because our society is so full of communication now, it's so full of transport, we find it so easy to communicate and move around that we really wonder how it was done in the past. And the other thing is, of course, they're tiny little time capsules. Everything in that shipwreck, from the ship itself to the cargo to the personal items of the crew themselves, we know that they must have been in use at the same time. So they make a really good fixed point in chronologies that can sometimes float about a bit.
I like the pun, so that's good.
Oh, float. Yes, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, look, let's investigate this shipwreck a little further, because unlike San Monday wreck, the one in Orkney that we told you about a few months ago. We do actually already know a little bit about this one. And let's bring in Tom Cousins, who's a maritime archaeologist at Bournemouth University. Great to have you on the podcast, Tom. And you were down there on the beach, weren't you, shortly after that wreck was discovered. So what was it like?
I mean, it's only a part of a much bigger wreck that we've worked on underwater for the last 20 years or so. And that was broken up in the 1630s into various parts. And really, we thought that project was done and dusted. It's been published quite recently. And I get a phone call during the book launch for the Swash Channel wreck. Oh, this new bit of wreckage has appeared. And it's literally, you look at the pictures and go, that looks very familiar. All the joints are the same. And I've gone down there. We went down there and looked and just looked at the joints, the scarves, how it's put together. And you're like, that's identical to the shipwreck on the seabed. And I've actually got timbers off the seabed now, the digital images, put them into the 3D model we've made of it, and they fit perfectly. So it's a very good chance this has come from the fame of Horn.
That is so ironic that the day you have the launch of the book, you find a bit more of it. But tell me more about what is the ship? So it's from the 1630s and it's called the Fame.
Yes, so it's a Dutch West Indiaman. It's probably going out to Venezuela to pick up salt. And in 1631, it was moored up in Studland Bay, which is a well-known anchorage. We've got records going back to the early medieval period about how good an anchorage is. It dragged its anchor. It drifted into the middle of the shipping channel into Poole Harbour, blocked the channel, and they had to salvage it at the time to clear the channel off. So Wessex Archaeology found it in 2004 when Poole Harbour were dredging out the main channel. And we at Bournemouth University started excavating it from 2005. And we finished that excavation in 2013, but then obviously got all the post-ex beyond that. The ship itself is about 40 metres long. It's one of these big transatlantic traders.
Yeah, that's actually pretty big, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's one of probably the biggest ships of its time going out there. And the closest parallel to it is the Vasa in Sweden, which is a ship built with the same sort of plan, except they decided to make it bigger into a warship. And obviously it didn't work because it failed on its maiden voyage. But these ships are well known. We've got bits of them in Australia, surviving in Australia and in the Far East. So they are very well, these Dutch ships are, they did get everywhere at the time, and they're a very key part of the foundation of globalization and the transatlantic, transoceanic empires.
So the ship had been mainly underwater, and that's where you'd been doing your work on it primarily. It's only now that this bit has been uncovered on the beach. So what work were you able to do on it when it was underwater?
When it was underwater, we've excavated the majority of the port side. It's in three sections underwater. We did a full excavation. We uncovered the bits that were at risk, so the bits jutting out to the channel. We cut those off and we've uncovered them. And they're currently in store, but some parts are on display in Poole Museum and the rest is going to Poole Museum shortly. And we've more or less buried the rest of it on the seabed in sandbags, which is what we do as maritime archaeologists to protect things. We just rebury them.
And did you say it was deliberately sunk?
So it, when it, in 1631, it dragged its anchor and ran aground. And what we think is it broke its back. So the keel snaps, so it obviously couldn't survive as a ship anymore. So the salvaging company, so Jacob the diver, they're a salvage company in 1630, they would have ripped the wreck apart to get as much cargo and as much goods that they can reuse as possible. And it's probably during that salvage operation that a chunk of the ship fell off, drifted off into Studland Bay, and it was probably then just got swallowed by the dunes as they've been growing up. Now the storms come in, it's revealed, so it's right where the surf line is. So it's probably been buried since 1630 on the beach.
Wow, that opens a whole new door into the world of salvage and diving in the 17th century. That's extraordinary. How on earth was that done?
So it's mainly by using things like diving bells. So you just compress air, so you pump air down into a bell. You think you invert a bell, it traps the air in there. You pump the air down to keep the pressure, and people could work for a short amount of time. A lot of the salvage was probably done by ripping the decks off. So it's only the wreck's in 7 metres of water, and we know it was probably at least 10 metres. So it's probably jutting out the water by quite a lot. The rudder is 8 metres long, for example, and that goes from the keel up to the waterline. We know it would be jutting out the water. So what they'd have done is they'd have just cut as much as they could away and then tied barrels at low tide. And as the tide comes up, they'll rip the deck off using the power of the tide as well. So anything that floats, you can grab it, you put hooks through it. And basically, eventually, the whole wreck will fall apart into its component pieces. And what we've got on the beach is just one of those pieces, so a big chunk of the hull.
So what does this ship tell you about what was going on in terms of trade, in terms of communication between countries in Europe and indeed across the world at that time?
So there's quite a lot of things from archaeology and history about this time period. So this is sort of the time period about the Restoration. We're having a few wars with the Dutch, and this is where the British Empire, or what would become the British Empire, and the Dutch Empire are both sort of vying for dominance. So what we're finding with this ship is that we can start seeing how the Dutch built their ships faster and quicker and industrial, on a more industrial scale, before then the English take over and then they start catching up. So there's things like windmill powered saws. We can see the saw marks in the timbers where they used to convert the trees into the planks to build the ships. You can start seeing how they constructed these ships in those time and the methods they would to make sure that they could transfer those long distances across the ocean and deal with storms and biological attack.
So a bit of a kind of an arms race of shipbuilding at the time.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Tom. It's been absolutely fascinating hearing all about it. And hopefully we'll talk to you again with your next amazing discovery.
Well, hopefully in the next week or so, we should have that wreck off the beach and into our conservation labs.
Well, good luck with it. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek, where we're now offering our Time Team members even more from the podcast over on Patreon. And after getting feedback from you, thank you very much for it, we're now going to be bringing you every episode that we do ad-free. And today, by the way, something a little bit more special for you, because we've recorded an additional mini episode to answer some more of the questions you've been asking, because we've had loads of questions that have come in, and loads of them have come in following our most recent Time Team episode about the return to the Princely Burial, which you can go and watch now on YouTube. So on Patreon right now, you can hear Helen answering those questions and talking about the dig itself. Now, if you want to know more, you want to discover more, basically everything else that you get when you support us as a Time Team member, head over to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. And remember, your generosity allows us to do more archaeology and make more programmes as well.
Now, Stonehenge is probably one of the most recognisable landmarks in the UK. The prehistoric megalithic structure sits on Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire and has intrigued and even baffled historians, engineers, and of course archaeologists for generations. Now, more than ever, researchers are widening their interest in the site to the areas surrounding the henge itself, in the hope that understanding other features in the local landscape might offer more clues as to how and why Stonehenge was constructed. Martin's been catching up with Time Team's Professor Henry Chapman in his office at the University of Birmingham to hear about the work he's been doing to understand the ancient structure.
So what we're looking at here is some of the drawings from excavations at Stonehenge.
This is all on sort of tracing paper.
Yeah, so it's called Permatrace, and it's sort of drawing film. So it allows us to draw, yeah, and do the recording in the fields even when it's raining. So Stonehenge is just an incredible chalkland landscape. And I mean, you can see here, this is one of our excavation plans of one of the pits at Stonehenge. It's all cut into chalk, which makes it a very interesting environment archaeologically to work in. I mean, at one level, it's really straightforward to see features. You know, because sometimes when we're on site, you kind of, where's the ditch? You know, it's hard to see. Whereas on chalk, it's a lot easier. But having said that, the actual chalk itself is really soluble. So just the actual, with rain in the past, you were talking about in antiquity, that sort of dissolves the chalk and sort of redeposits it. So what might look like just chalk is quite often archaeology as well. So at face value, it looks really quite straightforward, but it rarely is. The various projects we've had at Stonehenge, they've all started really with geophysics. You know, when you go to Stonehenge, you can see things which are upstanding, the barrows, the circle. But what you can't see is what's been ploughed away. And so what the geophysics it shows is that landscape was absolutely chocker full of all sorts of other things sort of throughout prehistory. But then when it comes to the excavations and some of the other work we've done, as ever, coring, but then excavations of particular areas. And what we're targeting with the excavations was actually, although we're looking at archaeology, our goal was to actually understand what the geophysics was telling us. And our particular focus was really on pits. People don't look at pits, you know, just a hole in the ground with, you know, infilled. What we were interested in was these subtle differences in geophysics, which would tell you that it was a tree throw or, you know, where a tree's fallen over, whether it was a pit, what sort of pit it was, and so on. So that's kind of where we were. But having said that, the excavations themselves produce some wonderful archaeology. The geophysics is showing us thousands and thousands of pits. But then when you start looking at other sorts of geophysics, you start finding there are differences. And then as we start excavating some of those and coring them, what we find is we've got different types of pits, shallow ones, deep ones, different dates, different sorts of fills, and getting that sort of almost a, in an AI sense, I suppose, a learning data set from which you can then reinterrogate your geophysics.
Is that Stonehenge there then? That's tiny. I can barely see it. We're looking at an aerial photograph at the moment. And then some. Have you just added some LiDAR data on top of it?
Yeah, so this is some geophysics data. You can see sort of features already within that landscape. You see all sort of the normal things you might see. Normally, say on a time team, when you sort of see the big features. But also what you see on time team, but we sort of more rarely look at, is just the amount of little pit features.
Right, so you've zoomed in there on some of this geophys data on a field just next to Stonehenge. It's hundreds of tiny little pixelated black blobs.
When you have sort of black and white together like that, it's probably more likely to be something iron. But all the ones which don't have that, you know, just clear black ones, they're all pits of some sort. Our goal with this project was really just to try and find out, what do they mean? Are they all the same period? You know, to what extent can we just interpret the geophysics data? There are thousands and thousands just in an area like Stonehenge. You can't dig them all. In some ways, it's quite bizarre. You go to work at Stonehenge and all of the, you know, world-famous monuments, and what we're focusing on is the pits. It's sort of quite perverse in some ways. But at the same point, it just demonstrates the richness of that landscape. Stonehenge, I think, is undoubtedly important. It's iconic. You know, having the sort of the lintels, the trilithons, makes it unique. Yeah, so it is a unique site, and it is. Yeah, and the density of monuments around that area is very high. But that's not unique. There are many other places, particularly river confluences, where you get a similar set of monuments. I remember many years ago I worked at a site called Catome, which is sort of on the River Trent, Tame, Mees confluence. And there you've got multiple cursus monuments, so sort of middle Neolithic. You've got causal enclosures, sort of earlier Neolithic. You've got laser henges and barrows. Yeah, so it's a very similar cluster. But what you don't have is the stones. But that's because it's an area which doesn't have natural stone. Now, I know that many of the stones from Stonehenge, or some of them, have been carried a long distance. But still, there are stones naturally in that landscape. So maybe Stonehenge is a little bit overrepresented in terms of our understanding of these periods. But having said that, when you work there, you always discover something sort of unique, exciting. There are other sites which are massively elaborate, but Stonehenge is special.
The thing is that the Stonehenge area has been important for so long, there might be centuries between these features. I mean, they won't all have been in use at the same time, but disentangling them to work out what was in existence at the same time and what had gone out of use before something else was built, it is incredibly complicated. And also, as we've seen with the Cern Abbas giant, the minute you dig a hole into chalk, you get a contrast between chalk and topsoil, and you get a contrast between chalk and grass. Pits, those holes that are dug into the chalk, they do seem to have been of extra importance around Stonehenge. They come in patterns, they come in lines, alignments, they come in circles. But as Henry says, those patterns are really difficult to tease out. It's going to be so exciting to see what he can do with what you might call big data around Stonehenge.
Now, the current Archaeology Awards is taking place at the end of this month and celebrates archaeological discoveries and the people who've made an outstanding contribution to the discipline over the past 12 months. There are awards for Archaeologist of the Year. You've got Book of the Year, Research Project of the Year, and Rescue Project of the Year.
And joining us now is Carly Hiltz, who's organised the awards, and our very own Naomi Supal, Time Team's environmental archaeologist, who's going to be one of the guest speakers. Hello, both of you.
Hi, Helen. Hello.
Hi, Helen. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Hello. Let's talk about these awards. I'm very excited about them because they sound like a lot of glitz and glam and people dressing up in their posh frocks and all of that. It's going to be very, very exciting. How big a deal, Carly, are they in the world of archaeology and archaeologists?
They always seem to be really important to the people who we nominate. We get a great response. People are very enthusiastic about promoting their nomination. And to be honest, they are important because they're recognising the wonderful work that's being done in archaeology across the country.
I bet. Yeah, I bet everybody's very keen to be part of them. And how does it actually work? How are the awards decided and how does it work on the night?
So in terms of nominations, for the projects, the research projects and the rescue projects, we draw up a long list of all of the excavations that have been features in CA in the last 12 months. Books ditto, we need to have reviewed the book in the last 12 months. Archaeologist of the Year is a little more flexible. It's people, you know, who have done wonderful work of the year. When we've got our long lists, we then have a meeting with our editor-in-chief, Andrew Selkirk, and our panel, and we go through all of the long list and whittle that down to a short list of nominations that we're going to put forward to the public. And voting is open to everybody. It's not just subscribers. Anybody in the general public can vote. That's why projects and archaeologists are pushing their own nomination, because anybody can vote for them. We want everyone to be able to recognise what these people are doing. And yeah, it's announced at the end of the conference. We've got the lovely Natasha Bilson announcing the results this year, which will be lovely. It's not that formal, I've got to say. I mean, you know, archaeologists aren't always a particularly formally dressed bunch. No, everybody's welcome. People wear what they're comfortable in. It's an exciting event, but I wouldn't say it's red carpet level of glamour, possibly. But very exciting and important people.
It's red carpet for archaeologists, yeah. I would say, who are used to sort of scrabbling around in dirt. I think that's probably what's going on there. Naomi, let me bring you in here. I'm keen to know about the stuff that you're going to be talking about in your speech. But before we do that, I just wanted to get your thoughts on some of the people and the projects who are nominated this year. Which ones have caught your eye?
Well, there's quite a few that's caught my eye. There's so many good things. I mean, I have to say, the Melsonby Hoard, as a Yorkshire girl, I mean, what a fantastic site, find. Because often, and you know this as well, Helen, sometimes we find really, really nice objects, but the amount that was found has really kind of turned things on its head in terms of what we think about Iron Age wealth and trade. And you know, even now in some of my researches, it's like, oh, things were a bit backwards up north type thing compared to the south. There is, you know, there's always been a north-south divide. And this hoard really has got the power to turn that around. So I'm very interested in that project as well. So yeah, there's a number of things there. And then I'm really pleased to see that there are projects that have been run for research and rescue, but have been sort of at the helm of that archaeology. It's not like university research. They are commercial archaeology companies. And it's always really nice to see the hard work that goes on in the really, really hard conditions that commercial archaeology is. You know, it's a tough business. And the results that you can get are absolutely fantastic. So I can't wait to hear more about that. I wish I had more votes that I could have cast at the time. But yeah, I think there's everything to play for. Oh, and book-wise, I mean, my heart, you know, if anybody that knows me, my heart is an island. And I did at GCSE and A-level a lot about Irish history. And as complex and as confusing as that was, I love the fact that there's a book called The Irish Civil War Dugout. And it's sort of the first research excavation ever conducted on a site like this. And that is something that I would really like to have a look at, to really get a different angle from learning about that, the history of that and the politics of that. I think this could be quite, what's the word?
Groundbreaking.
That's the word. Yeah, I know, the most obvious word for an archaeologist to use, and I couldn't think of it. But yeah, groundbreaking, absolutely.
Yes, because that's so modern. The Civil War being 20th century.
Yeah, exactly.
So these awards bring everything together. Then Naomi and Carly, the commercial side, the academic side, the voluntary sector. Everything from deep prehistory to really modern archaeology. It's a way of everybody getting together and focusing on the richness of British archaeology.
That's always our aim when we're drawing up our nominations. As you say, we want to cover as many different facets of archaeology as we can, because you're right, it is a wonderfully diverse field. And we try to make sure that we've done historical periods covered, different parts of the UK covered. So yeah, I'm glad you like the spread, because we do try to make it as broad a coverage as we can.
So Naomi, what are you actually going to be doing at the event? You're one of the speakers?
I am. I'm absolutely thrilled / partly terrified to come down. No, Carly very kindly invited me to come and speak about environmental archaeology. And I don't know if people know this, but I first met Carly with the original time team, and you were a researcher, weren't you? And I just always remember you running around with a clipboard going from trench to trench, updating in the early days of like DigWatch, as when we tried to trial it then. Carly got in touch with me and said, would I like to give a talk on environmental archaeology, because she wasn't sure if there'd ever been a talk at Current Archaeology Live, at least not in the time that you've been there as editor. So I said, yes, of course. So my talk, it will be quite general, just explaining to people from the beginning what environmental archaeology is, what it looks like, what it takes to get from the soil coming out of the ground to some of the results that I get. And yeah, so it's just going to be a fairly general talk with some really nice examples from commercial archaeology and things that obviously we've done with Time Team as well, especially through the last 5 years or so. I'm really looking forward to it. But yeah, that is a huge stage there, Carly. It's in the same room, isn't it?
Yeah, it's where we were before. We're expecting about 500 people in the audience. Don't be scared, it's a friendly
audience.
Don't
worry about it, Naomi, there's only 500 people.
Well, honestly, because it's a great space actually for people to come and listen. It's not like a small lecture theatre. There's a big screen and there's lots of nice comfy seats.
We're partnered with UCL and they have some lovely venues, and yeah, we're excited to use that space.
I just fear that I may need to wear a hi-fi jacket, otherwise I'm going to sound like a disembodied voice if they can't see this tiny speck of me on that massive stage. So I need a flashing light or something, I don't know. But no, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm very very happy that Carly invited me. I really am.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Carly. Thank you, Naomi. And good luck to everyone who's nominated.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's about it for us this week on the podcast. Next week, Helen's going to be answering some of your questions, and there'll be another edition of Helen's Find, where Helen talks about an object that's been discovered through archaeology. And what find are you going to be talking about then, Helen?
This one is going to be a surprisingly colourful object, which might in some strange way be linked to Cern Abbas.
Okay, well, make sure you're listening next week for that. In the meantime, have a great week, and we'll speak to you soon on the Time Team podcast.